Blog Talk Radio.
Empty promises, believing all your lies.
There. Welcome to another episode of Shattered Innocence. My guest today, again, is Blackstone Lawyer, The Black Widow Chapter, Part 2. Let me go ahead and read. Abuse affects our lives in so many ways. What do we do when we're too scared to tell? Well, we have trusted someone and they did not help. Sometimes someone asks, what did you do to get punished this way? Abuse is abuse. Abuse is not punishment. Abuse is torture, crippling, and debilitating. What advice would you give others to help them through the horrendous memories? Are you there for the person or part of the knife in your friend or relative's back, since you may have turned a blind eye to it? Are you claiming to advocate against abuse but condemn the people who tell and share their stories? Do you want to be a part of the solution or part of the problem? Let's stand united and discuss ways in which we may help others. What ways have helped you in your healing journey? Are you in a constant battle fighting the negative forces within? Stop. Let's encourage one another. Are you an officer in the judicial system not doing your job to help the victim? That means you're not doing your duty. Your duty is to serve and protect. How do we open the public's eyes so they can acknowledge and feel the need to help protect the children and our citizens? The children are our future. You matter. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome Blackstone Lawyer. Hello, and welcome back to Shattered Innocence.
Hello, darling. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Hope you're doing well.
I'm doing fair to middling, I guess. It's beautiful weather out here today, so just out here soaking up some rays for a little bit. And it was really messy for the past couple of days, but up here in the Smokies, it's just magnificent weather today.
That's great. You took my line. I usually say the fair to Midland.
Well, that's if you ever want to surprise people in Western North Carolina, you say the same thing because it's what a lot of people over in that area use as well. Then I don't think they realize it spreads out throughout the Southeast. I sometimes tell them fair to partly cloudy.
I like that.
Yeah.
So I remember where I was taking notes from the last time, and I didn't get to the last end of it.
Because
I kept having phone calls, but we're pretty close to the end where you had talked about the induction of Timothy King, and they tried to pin it on the Black Panthers and Doug McRae, and I can't remember maybe that other person was involved, and then they ended up moving their thing to Atlanta, Georgia, if I'm not mistaken. Is that what you said?
Yes, ma'am. They during Timothy King's abduction, there was two adult males seen with him before, during, and after. And that was Doug McRae and Sam Duncan Sr. Big Ray Duncan's brother, the founder of Duncan Oil.
Right.
His brother Sam,
wow,
who lives in Murphy, North Carolina.
Another big wig.
Well, yes, ma'am. There's a lot of big wigs when start revealing who they are. You might as well call them the Billionaire's Pedophile Club, because that's much up to what type of people they are. And some of them actually run this country from, behind the scenes. and banking and entertainment and, you know, and of course oil and lumber and, I mean, some of your top industries in this country, some of them people are very much some of the most untrusted people in this nation.
Yeah, the thing that, like you had said before, also with the Kodak and the Polaroid, a lot of people trusted their films being made over there at Polaroid and Kodak, you know, and it's a shame how they ended up turning that around and getting our innocent pictures that we took of our children and then selling them overseas and such as.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dale Montegraff is not his real name. That's his alias. And believe it or not, Bill Codger, when I go to work out at a particular gym in Duluth, Georgia, he is all the time in that locker room. He's retired. He's even got children that are grown. Now, a lot of people want to know who this Dale Montegraff is. Well, he lives in Marietta, Georgia, but he drives all the way out to Duluth because that's his favorite spot to hook up the young guys there in the locker room. And every time I go in there, he looks at me and wishes me the most successful year that I can have every time I walk in there. And I think it's just
he knows who you are.
Probably afraid I'm going to co-cocked him. Because I have had a reputation, which normally in defense, co-cocking some of these guys and putting them in ICUs. Sam Duncan Jr., he wound up in ICU for 5 days with a broken jaw and fractured cheekbone, one of those. If I didn't show up to fight him, I wasn't going to live to see dark.
Yeah,
then when
it
was I got
a matter
over there,
of him or you.
Mm-hmm. And then when I got over there, well, if I lost the fight, they were going to kill me. But now I could beat him up, but I couldn't kill him because if I killed him, well, they were going to kill me. So I just did the next best thing. I just almost killed him. And
right.
Went over there and sat,
and then you
sat in the ICU.
And
pray for his recovery.
Yeah, well, in the hospital, you sat there in the bed.
Well, Sam was like, you mean you want to go in and sit with my son? I'm like, yeah. Think he's going to live if I don't go in there and pray for him. Oh, really? Well, how do I know you won't brainwash him? I asked him, I said, well, which would you much rather have, a dead son or a brainwashed son? And he goes, I'd much rather have a brainwashed son. I said, well, there you go. He goes, well, how do I know you'll leave when he comes to? I said, if he tells me to leave, I won't even say a word, I'll leave. And sure enough, when he came to, he saw me sitting over there. He wasn't too happy and told me to leave, and I didn't say a word. I got up to leave. Then he told the nurse he wanted me to talk to him. So I wound up staying there for 4 days with him, you know, getting him drinks whenever he'd come awake and wanted something to drink and help him with his drink. You know, kind of do for the old boy, kind of like I would do a friend or family member. I'm not going there to disrespect him at all. And
yeah, you knew that
he had
been brainwashed himself, basically, you know.
Well, you don't know what to do because some of these old guys, when they're brought up by those type of parents, you know, they're groomed into that. They think what they're doing is normal. This is, it's just the way it is. And you really feel sorry for them. You know, you look at people like Hunter Biden, same thing. You know, he was brought up the way he was.
And you know what the bad thing is? You know, a lot of people try to blame Burke Ramsey for what happened to John Monnet, but he's a victim of circumstance as well, to where if he talks, he knows he's going to get killed because, heck, that's what happened to his sister 2 years before, John Monnet.
Well, the same thing with his oldest half-sister, Beth. You know, that was no accident.
Exactly.
Yeah, as many times as they've tried to chase me around lower Alabama in the 90s from 93, really to the first part of 96, they were down there trying to chase me around, unsuccessfully, of course. Judge McLaughlin crashed his 1971 Buick Centurion into the brick mailbox of Grady Rawls, the owner of Grady Rawls Construction, the largest road contracting firm for lower Alabama, of all brick mailboxes. That's the one that Judge McLaughlin crashed into, trying to chase me into it. Old UPS truck, and we call them bread trucks because they're those single body trucks, you know.
Have you noticed something, though, that a lot of times when they go to do this, a lot of these victims, they end up saying they crash into a bread truck. Well, you know, y'all need to start being speculative when you hear a person crash into a box truck, because it could have been a setup.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hope word gets to, you know, Matt Darrington's family, you know, because Matt Darrington comes from a really wonderful family that, you know, that was a man. Matt Darrington was very much 100% gentleman. I mean, when I first met Beth, I mean, I would be lying if I, you know, just by talking with her and meeting with her, and her demeanor and the warning that she brought me over the contract that they had put out on me again in 1991. It's one reason why I'm still alive.
Right.
You know, 1978, and I don't know why my dad didn't do it then, but he wanted to give me a chance to go in the military. You know, do my service to the country, which, of course, I couldn't get in from a medical record, or I would have. But he thought I would go in the service and get out of the service. And in 1996, I'd go and, you know, collect 6 acres of Bentley Farm with a house and $450,000. And that would give me money to, you know, start a life, get into developing and building if I wanted to, you know, follow his footsteps like I wanted to. And that's why he had that set up the way he did. And, you know, after the birth of JonBenet, Beth, you know, came down to meet, you know, her little half-baby sister. She came to Marietta. And she said the moment that she held that little child, her heart just melted. And she had been sexually abused by her daddy. So here she was with a new half-sister. She was really more concerned in her entire life than she had ever been concerned whenever she first held JonBenet. And she determined that she was not going to allow her little half-sister to go through the same sexual abuse that she went through that started when she was 7 years of age.
Yeah, and people might wonder why they were constantly after you and everything, but this stemmed all the way back from when you were 6 years old.
Oh, yes,
that
ma'am.
They tried a lot of crap on you. So if everybody go back and look at Mother Blog Talk, there's two other interviews that I've interviewed him, and you can get the backstory on a lot of that, so then you'll understand why he had to keep running and why they kept chasing after him.
Yeah, I've lived in Willis, Texas. I've lived in Pensacola, Florida. I've lived in Evergreen, Alabama. I've lived in Whittier, North Carolina. I've lived all around different parts of Atlanta trying to avoid these people. Just try to have as close to a normal life as you want to have, you know. I don't like getting out into other people's personal business, you know, and I really don't like people really being nose up into my personal business.
Right.
You know, I've been accused of being a thief, an informant. They throw some people there, and I don't know when they started this rumor, but I found out in 2001, and it almost got them killed because they hired some boys from the Dixie Mob to take me out, and they found out that I was not an informant, nor was I a thief. They had been told that I went to some drug dealer's house and stole something like $4,000 or $5,000 worth of merchandise from this guy and turned around and ratted him out and got him busted for drugs. That's
wow.
The kind of lies that they was putting out on me. People want to hurt me or kill me. And it led to fight after fight. I had one guy about 6'3" try to jump on me over one night in Helen, Georgia. I didn't even get two sips out of my beer. And this guy's up going to swing down on me. So, like I said, I don't start fights. I finish them. And I finished it. The bouncers didn't even want to intervene because when they came up behind them, I did the same thing I did in the second brawl, you know, less than an hour later. I turned around, told them to back off, and I went back, dodged this guy's punches, and commenced whooping that doggone butt of his. So,
right.
Of course, they had to call a unit out there and escort him to the hospital, airline fractures of both his cheekbones. And the moment they got him to the hospital in Cleveland, they had to turn around and bring two more. I went to another place. The bouncers come up and they told me, well, you're going to have to leave. We know you didn't start the fight, but our policy is you get in a fight, you have to leave for the day. And, you know, of course, the guy, he was sitting over at the table with his wife and one of her friends. And I said, yeah, well, what about him? He goes, well, he's going to have to leave too. And he said, no, there. Well, I need an ambulance. I'm like, oh, boy. You know, which, you know, I wasn't liable. It was self-defense. You know,
right.
I could understand if I threw the first punch or something like that. Oh, they would have landed me in jail. It would have been felony. You go out and you start a fight on somebody like that and brutally injure them, you're going to be charged with a felony in the state of Georgia. And same thing in the second place. That place had live band and didn't even get two sips out of that beer. And this other boy decided he wanted to come up and, you know, start a fight with me. He had two of his buddies going to come up behind me. And, you know, I've experienced it before. They grab you behind and the guy sits there and he gets the wail the daylights out of you. So
was
I turn around and push those two
guys back. Was it because that one people, the certain people kept trying to get these different people hiring them to do that to you or whatever?
Well, yeah, Mike and Fred and Jeff Cook was over there that night. And this is actually, I think it's the night that I'm actually met Doug Duncan, the guy that sees lobbyists for the logging industry.
Uh-huh.
And and, of course, you're talking Zell Miller's people. You know, of course, he's going to come down and, you know, hang around with people that sell lumber and that are in the lumber business, Murphy Building Supply. you know, because that's who pays his, you know, pays his salary is the logging industry. And, swell guy. I've not really known much of anything really bad about him. You know, you can't say just because they're with his group of people, but they're a bad person, you know, because it's not the way it works. You know, the, you know, these people associate with very good people all the time, and these good people don't know who they're dealing with. That's what it boils down to. But they had a guy decide he's going to come in, you know, that second brawl, he's going to come in and grab me anyway. Well, he got to meet a table on the way to the floor, and he got put in ICU for a few days. So that's what landed my picture over in the White County Jail from 97 or 98 to the time they built the new county jail, which was in 2007. And they just, you know, they didn't move it to the new jail. They just tore it down the old jail. You know, the picture went around along with it, I guess, because they figured they didn't need it. It'll hardly go to hell in anyway. I do pass through Cleveland. It's, you know, just passing through. I have no business over there whatsoever, and I don't have friends that live over there.
Right.
But they had my picture on the wall for a long time where the deputies would, you know, see me, and they would know to keep an eye out. And somebody came to try to jump on me, they would be over there to assist them with medical if needed. And what had happened with those two guys, or the three that jumped me the second time, two of them were already out on probation. They had already served their 16-day jail sentence.
Well, that wasn't even supposed to be.
Yeah, they were given like 12 months or 24 months probation. Don't know if they were charged with felonies or misdemeanors, but they wound up serving 16 days in jail. There was this couple that went up there on vacation the previous year, thinking their honeymoon, from Savannah, Georgia. And they said something, you know, to the guy's wife, and of course he said he's going to defend his wife's honor. And they wound up jumping on him and put him in the hospital for a night. The one
wow.
that started the fight, he was still out on bond. He hadn't pled guilty yet. And that wasn't the first time that, you know, they had problem with these three guys jumping on people over there. They had beat up one local boy really bad, put him in the hospital for a few days a few years earlier. So they were kind of the regulars over there at the White County Jail when it comes to jumping on, you know, three on one. I guess they were regulars over there.
Right.
So, of course, when the detective called me up at my office, because what happened was the second bar, they called the unit out there. And, of course, their uncle almost shot me, so I was an informant. I said, informant for what? Pedophiles?
Uh-huh.
That's how I got out of getting shot. I said, oh, so it's not proper to go out here and report a pedophile to the authorities? So he shut up. He decided he didn't want to shoot me. The woman sitting over there, this guy's wife, she goes, well, sir, he was just coming over to break up the fight. I said, ma'am, that is not the way you break up the fight. I said, the moment my daddy moved me from Morganton, Georgia, down to Marietta, Georgia in 1976, I was fighting every day of my life. As many times as I've had people come up and grab me from behind where the other one could wail away on me, I said, no, ma'am, your husband came up to grab me. And If I were you, I would get him out in the automobile as fast as possible. I said, I don't know if you heard of Sam Duncan up there in Murphy. He's got his gas stations up there. But his boy just got out of the ICU for 5 days 2 months ago. And if they didn't get him there within minutes, he wouldn't have survived. So I'll help you get your husband in the car where you can drive him to the hospital. I say you don't need to be honoring no doggone speed limit, but you don't need to be driving like a doggone maniac trying to get him there. And I looked at the bouncers. I said, has anybody called the sheriff's department yet? They said, yeah, they got a unit on the way right now. I said, well, there's your escort. So, of course, they didn't want my help loading her husband in the back seat of the car. You know, I guess his brother, buddy, or whoever, cousin, or whatever. And the bouncers helped get him in the car. And the deputy, he got there. I just went over and gave him one of my business cards. So I got a phone call on the following Tuesday from a detective over there. And I thought he was going to try to, you know, put out a charge on me. And when he started asking me questions, you know how these police are. You have to be really careful with them. And oh, yeah. He goes, oh, no, Mr. Rogers, I'm not trying to get you admit to anything to where I can take out a warrant for you. And that's when he started explaining the history of the three guys. He goes, we already talked to people at both establishments. They said you were not a problem. And the first establishment, you respected their request. You left the way they asked you to leave. You didn't mouth off or anything. So we know you're not a problem, so we're not trying to get a warrant for you, but we need a statement out of you. And that's when he told me about, you know, the couple from Savannah getting, you know, the husband getting beat up and all the other problems they had out of them. I said, well, you know what? I'll make an exception. I'll do a statement on this. So, but you know, detective, he came all the way up to Murphy, and it was pretty neat because my service department manager, she got to hear it. My branch manager, he got to hear it, and that's where they took my picture at. Was right there at my office, and it was not put on the wall by any of their deputies nor by any of their informants. Now, there was one boy over in Murphy. He got arrested about a couple of weeks later, went over there and saw my picture on the wall and come back trying to tell people, well, he's over there working with the White County Sheriff's Department. So it kind of helped my reputation in Murphy, to where I didn't have, you know, too many people wanting to, you know, start a fight with me once they heard that. So it really minimalized a lot of problems for me. But that was pretty much my life story. Don't start the fight, never would throw the first punch, but I always finished them.
Yeah.
But
and your own brother, your long time that you,
ma'am.
And I said your own brother set you up and just like you protected your mom, you know, when your brother tried to, you know, do it to your mom, you know.
Well, yeah, and of course my cousin Robert was part of it, which he's really
and
not.
What was Robert? When you mentioned Roger earlier, that's Roger Nance, right? And then
yes, that's Roger. That's Roger Nance. No,
then,
Robert Veach.
But the brother, your cousin, is Robert who?
Veach. V-E-I-T-C-H. He's a former Cobb County police officer.
Oh, man.
He was involved in the Atlanta child murders with John Ramsey. I know that for a fact because I went down there one night in 1982, pleading for my brother and Roger's safe return because they were supposedly being held by this cult who was engaging in child sacrifices. I took one of my high school buddies who drove me down there, and I went in those woods. I bluffed them, told them there's a group of people out there waiting on me to come back out with two police officers. And I bluffed my way out of those woods. And I had to get out of there before that one guy went up and looked up and would only see one automobile up there, and I would have been finished. But I got out of there, and that's how I found out that my cousin Robert was involved with Ed Bentley Jr., because Eddie was right there with him. Robert and Ed Jr., they're like best friends. They graduated Sprayberry High School together. I did not know this, but they were best friends. And and they were involved in
everything.
Ed Bentley Jr.
He graduated with Ed Bentley Jr.?
Yeah, Robert graduated high school with Ed Bentley
Jr.
from Sprayberry High School.
So he was, so he was part of the pedophilia ring himself too, huh?
Yes, ma'am.
So it makes you wonder whether they had initiated him in when he was younger too.
Well, I'm kind of wondering the background of his biological dad family. I don't know his birth last name. My Uncle James married Aunt Essalie, and she already had three children. Now, she miscarried on the fourth child. They were going to name John. So they didn't have children together. Matter of fact, when Jim Stubbs went to work for my dad, he was breaking the ground on Frankie Lane. Well, my dad named Frankie Lane after Robert's sister, Frankie.
Wow. I want to tell people if they want to call in to ask questions, you can call in at 563-999-3517. Again, the number is 563-999-3517. If you can continue on, I'm sorry.
Okay. But I'm trying to remember where we last left off on the conversation last time we had when I lost signal there.
It was a little bit after the after they had moved to Atlanta because they were trying to frame the Black Panthers over there. So it was
okay.
A little bit after that. I didn't get to finish listen to the last 10 to 15 minutes, but it was right around there when I had to stop and then come in here to this, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, Atlanta was a melting pot of racism back in the 1970s and really into the 1990s. And it started dying down in the 90s when people found out that I was actually out there stopping the majority of their terrorist attacks and almost getting killed numerous times trying to do it. But I succeeded, stopping 26 out of 31 terrorist attacks. Well, you're welcome. Succeeded in getting the 263-pound hydrogen bomb disarmed and surrendered to the ATF the night of January 28, 1998. And Governor James Baxter Hunt Jr. did not want to go to the rear parking lot of my office over there at Electrolux and try to negotiate with Matt McRae to get truck bomb number 11. That's how many they had built out of Murphy, North Carolina, after they failed to hit the FBI field office down there in Mobile, Alabama, 17 minutes after Joey Davis hit the new women's health care clinic. And yes, he was driving Eric Rudolph's pickup truck, and yes, he was wearing Pam's brown wig. And so, no, Peter, Kevin Langan is not the only cross-dresser of the area Republican Army. There's Josephine Davis, the anonymous caller to the Centennial Park attack. But the information I got out of Doug McRae, the radio show, was his admissions to his involvement with John Ramsey. They were involved together in the Charlie Chop-Off. They were involved together in the Oakland County child murders. Doug was best friends with Frank Sheldon, Francis Duffield Sheldon, from North Fox Island pedophile ring. Frank
and
is buried.
Say that, did they, the Frank Sheldon thing, they try to say that he was buried in another country. Is he the one that they were trying to claim that?
Yeah, I call him the zombie. He faked his death July the 1996 in New Amsterdam. Well, he had Andy Strassmeyer up on Andy out around Europe and Germany out there after the Oklahoma City bombing. And he got him a fake death certificate in New Amsterdam, so he wouldn't have to worry about the FBI looking for him so hot. So he could free up, go over there, play some golf over there at the Brasstown Valley Golf Club with old Zell Miller and the boys. You know, there's someone, oh, aren't you Frank Sheldon? No, I'm Frank Torrey. You know, nothing Hispanic looking about him, but that was his alias, Frank Torrey. And, he's buried east of Andrews, North Carolina, up Highway 64, or 74, excuse me. He was killed at the same time that Dave Holloway, the CIA, and Andrea Strassmeyer were executed in self-defense. Robert Miller, the leader of Elohim City, came out to claim all three of their bodies on the, I think it was the 25th of September, 1999. And they intended to come out there, kill me, take all three of their bodies back to Elohim City and bury them. Well, when they got out there thinking they were going to kill me, they found out they were outgunned and outnumbered. Those people over there in Western North Carolina, they're kind of people, they'll do anything in the world for you. They'll give you a shirt off your back. If you're running from the law, they'll hide you unless you're a child rapist. And they're not going to hide you then. But they've been known to hide armed robbers, you know, bank robbers and drug runners and all that from the law, and bootleggers and all that from the law. They'll do anything in the world for you. And they don't agree with the government that we have, and you really can't blame them. But
exactly.
One thing they cannot stand is a liar. They, like I said, they'll do anything in the world for you. They really thought that Eric was out there doing what he thought was God's will, you know, out here, you know, killing these abortionists who were murdering these, you know, unborn babies, and was just this good old boy that would probably give you the shirt off his back and all that. And there really wasn't much to, you know, set them straight until they could find out on their own that he was not really in his mind doing what he thought was God's will. You're not pro-life if you stand against abortion, but yet you rape, murder, and torture children, you are not pro-life. Okay, there's nothing pro-life about that. And I've had some of my friends that know about this. They go out there and tell people, well, the only reason they were against the abortion industry was, you know, they were aborting, you know, potential victims. would be their only reason for standing against the abortion industry. And, that's sad. We should have never had an abortion industry to begin with.
A lot of doctors, and we already had it where, you know, if a woman had complications that was a health risk, they did go ahead and do something like that because of the health risk associated for the mama. So I don't see what the big problem is, why they needed all this other stuff either, you know?
Well, it's like Matt McRae that day. I had to go over there and get that truck bomb out of Murphy that afternoon. You know, he's the one that pointed out to me that the abortion industry was nothing but a tool for child sex traffickers, is all it was. And guys who, prey on rage girls.
Right.
And
the thing
Mark
about
Crutcher,
it is, when a lot of times when they did the abortions too, like I know some people that said it's pro-life, whatever your choice, a woman's body. But then later on, they got with a guy or something. They wanted to have kids, and then they found out that bad abortion messed them up for life when they couldn't have a kid, and they said they were forever haunted for the fact.
Yeah, I've ran into quite a few women like that. They had abortions, and they got married and decided they wanted to have a child and can't have the child because they had abortions.
Right.
And in some cases, they'll turn around and adopt a child because they can't have children together. Just get pets, and that's their children. I mean, it's sad. I remember this girl from Puerto Rico. It was the same thing. She went and got her an abortion. And I looked at her and I told her, I said, there's going to come a time you're going to want to have a baby and you're not going to have that baby. And sure enough, pregnant, miscarriage, she couldn't have children without miscarriages. Sad, but. You know, they want to say it's their body. Well, no, it's not their body. It's another human being. And, you know, you got the science, you know, want to sit there and say, well, they're a fetus, they don't even have nerves yet. Well, okay, whatever. I mean, it's
a
death sentence.
They had a heartbeat
period.
From the start. There was a heartbeat, you know what I'm saying? So if it had a heartbeat, well, that should tell them something, right?
Well, it's still a death sentence. I mean,
You're
putting an end to a human life. It's just because it's not born yet doesn't mean it's not a human being. But it's still the same with these children that they've been out here murdering, you know, for decades. And it looks like they decided to start up again out there in Delphi, Indiana. Nobody has been able to convince me yet that if Ricky Allen is guilty, that he acted alone. Because I know how this works.
They work in teams.
Well, yeah, they're probably around 30 to 100 people involved, those two girls' murders. Because this cult, it doesn't get smaller. Yeah, you'll have some members die off, but you'll have some over there. UGA over there in Georgia State University, Mercer University, and of course up there in Harvard and all them, they get brought into these secret societies. And, well, the Gridiron Secret Society is the Odinist cult that Allen's attorneys has brought to his defense. And they're trying to deny that he had any connections to that cult. But he was in the area at the time of the girls' abductions. They were killed elsewhere. And their bodies were placed where they were found. And so they were not killed where they were found. So there was no lone wolf operative in the Delphi murders. There was no lone wolf come creeping through the basement window of the Ramsey home. Okay. There was 18 people, guests, still in that house after all the other 25 guests left before John set the alarm. Big Ray
Johnson. And plus, did Beth not share with you about how the father threatened that he was going to do, tell us what he said that he was going to do to JonBenet?
He's going to rape her himself when he got home, and he was going to dress her up like a beauty queen when she got older. He was going to dye her hair blonde. Beth's greatest fear was her being put in these beauty pageants. He knew that. And he was going to pass her around like a hooker in a brothel before he killed her on a Christmas. And
there
were
a lot of
them
pedophiles there that night.
Well, he told her he was going to kill her on the anniversary of Jill Robinson's homicide. And that's what he did. 20 years later. From the date that John Ramsey shot Jill Robinson in the face, he had his youngest daughter, JonBenet Ramsey, murdered. That's a fact.
And there was quite a few people that was there at the time of the death, too, and they don't want to go like this. And they said that they left the party and all that, but no, there were still a lot of people there still at the house during when JonBenet died. Am I right or wrong?
Oh, you are correct. And some of those people could not believe that some of them didn't even know the murder had taken place until after it had taken place. And they could
not believe
that her own parents was involved in her murder. These people thrive off of blackmail. Okay, Jeff Epstein was their master of blackmail. It would take too long to get in the way this guy operated for them. But he was involved in the murder of JonBenet Ramsey. Ghislaine Maxwell, okay. She was all the time in the summers over in Hiawassee, Georgia, being seen with Eric Rudolph, having dinner with John, Patsy, and the children. Eric was her water skiing instructor during the summer of 96 because the Ramseys, Jeffy, and Ghislaine shared Big Ray Duncan's house with him on Lake Chattooga. During the winter when he was in Boulder, he would stay at the Ramseys.
Wow.
Okay, another one of John Ramsey's friends and partners in the Atlanta child murders is John Mark Carr's daddy.
Wow.
When JonBenet was murdered, where did John move the family to?
Georgia.
To Sandy Springs, less than 3 miles from John Mark Carr's daddy's house. You always hear this BS about, John Carr went out there and snuck into the house. John Carr didn't have to sneak in no doggone house.
No, they
John
said Carr they
spent plenty of
nights. We didn't lock our doors and not like, yes, you do. You still lock your door, especially somebody with that much money. You know, we knew that was a lie from the start, too.
Yeah, there's those people can't tell the truth if their lives depended on it.
I want to tell you about a video that I did. I want to tell you about a video I did on my YouTube channel the other day under Darlene J. Clark, It's a sting operation on Andrew David Mellon, ex-advisor to the Prince of Wales. And guess whose name was affiliated to that besides, of course, the higher-ups in the government? I mean, the king and queen, I mean, Prince Charles and all that kind of stuff. Guess whose name was mentioned?
Jimmy Carter?
No, Ghislaine Maxwell.
Oh, okay. Well, have you seen the picture of Rosalind Carter and John Wayne Gacy?
Yeah, you told me about that. You can explain that to the listeners, though, if you will.
Well, these politicians, you know, you think these serial killers, and which there are some out there that are lone wolves, they're not part of any group or secret society or anything like that. And I mean, they are out there. But the ones like Rex Harriman, John Wayne Gacy, of course, John Ramsey, okay, they're all members, believe it or not, of the Gridiron Society.
Yeah, that's a big group of people. Influential people.
Well, they're also known as the bankers.
Is there also an island that's off of Georgia as well, or is it just North Carolina?
No, you got Jekyll Island, and Robert Sapir, he does a real excellent job. He's like Donald Trump. He'll tell you all about these people, but he doesn't tell you the name of their secret society or their identities because it's so easy to say something all of a sudden. You're being chased in the rain toward a bread truck.
And Jekyll Island, is that close to Georgia?
Yes, that's down off the coast of Georgia near Brunswick.
That's another island that's for the pedophiles, just similar to Epstein Island, that a lot of people might not have heard about.
Well, a lot of people looks at it as a tourist destination. But you go down there, and this is how historically based this is. This is how long that they have been working in this country to do the communist takeover, and they've been failing miserably to do it. I mean, they've got us pretty much where they want us right now with their judges and their operatives and government positions, but, you know, it's kind of like, you know, a pimple when it festers up, you know, you squeeze a little bit, all the crap comes popping out of it, and that's about what's about to happen with the government right now. We're about to mash it, and all this crap and pus is about to come out of it, and that's going to take a lot of cleaning up because we got judges, we got prosecutors, we've got senators, we got congressmen, and Jim Jordan did not lie at all when he said there was over 44 CEOs and executives involved with the Bidens, okay, in child sex trafficking. He did not lie at all. They sat there and said there was two individuals that was putting information out on the internet, social media, about Hunter Biden. Well, by law, if it had been false, I'd be under the jail. Okay?
Right.
You can't go out here and put out that kind of information or misinformation about a member of the first family, because if you falsely accuse somebody of something, you're going to more than likely spend the rest of your life behind bars.
You know what's sad about that statement, though? You know, a lot of things that people had accused even of Trump doing and he didn't do, you know, it's sad to say that he kept getting accused of that falsely and nobody had to pay for that. But these other people that's doing this other stuff to try to destroy America, they're getting away with it.
Well, you know, you look at
away with it.
Well, you look at, you know, you look at the September 11th, 1996 fake attack of Rhonda Cook. That is Oklahoma City and Centennial Park bomber's first wife, Rhonda. You know, this woman winds up stabbed in the legs and calls 911 right around 1:30 p.m., right when I'm finishing my lunch in College Park, Georgia, working next door to the Easy Rental down there, cleaning upholstery that day. See, my
cell
job.
Far away
when
from where she's at.
Nope, that's right.
Far away from where she's at.
Mm-hmm. Drug Task Force Commander Mark Pigpen. Everybody calls him Pigpen up there. Ran the tag number. And my truck was still registered in Alabama in 96 while I was going through my divorce. And so on September 11th, 1996, around 11:48 a.m., the tag number of my 1985 red and white Dodge pickup truck got called in to dispatch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the son of a gun parked in the parking lot at Easy Rental in College Park, Georgia, just below the Atlanta airport. I had walked next door for my lunch at this Jamaican restaurant. It was the next plaza up. No need to get in my truck and drive. Just walk right over next door, sat down, had my hot wings, some fries, some sweet tea with lemon. There was about eight other customers there eating. I go up. And the moment I'm paying for my bill, paying my tab, 911 in Cherokee County gets called where I supposedly went up on a motorcycle, not in my pickup truck, knocked on my cook's door. His wife came to the door, and I wanted to bar her telephone, and she refused to let me use her telephone. So I forced my way through the screen door with a knife and started attacking her and stabbed her in the legs. And she managed to fight me off. And I got scared and ran out and got on the motorcycle and drove down the Flint Hill Road, made a right, and went down to the dead end. And nobody
wow.
had enough sense to ask her, well, where's his pickup truck?
Yes,
well,
you
we
got
ran
the tag
his tag number
for
in
the pickup truck. What was? How do you know?
Yeah. Well, the pickup truck wasn't at the dead end of Flint Hill Road. Okay. Well, how did I get there to get in my friend's house and jump on his Harley Davidson? What did I do? Walk there? I sure as hell didn't drive there. Hell, the truck parked at College Park.
But didn't somebody try to set you up by going ahead and doing that just to make it look like you did?
Mm-hmm. They had already placed some of the wiring used for the explosives in the Centennial Park attack and the supply box in the back of my pickup truck.
Oh, wow.
So when I got charged for the attack of Rhonda Cook, well, they're going to come up with a search warrant, and they was going to go search my pickup truck for the knife that was used to attack her, okay? So in the process of searching my vehicle, they were going to find this electrical wire and stuff, and they were going to compare it and come to, oh, wait a minute. Here's our bomber to the Centennial Park attack. That was the game. That was their plan. Frank Sheldon.
It's so easy
of all
to prank
people.
Somebody in a, when they throw the stuff in the back of anybody's pickup truck, huh?
Well, Frank Sheldon flew in from Europe. I had told
yeah.
this before I went to college. Dumb, partner,
yeah.
Sheldon was coming to town by Doug next door. He's going to come hang out for 2 weeks. So I get back the following Monday. I spent the entire week. I made almost $2,000 that week cleaning upholstery. And so I
here I was going through divorce, stress, needing money. I get down and I have a really great week, $2,000 in my pocket. I knew then when I got back to Murphy, I could go out and with ease just, you know, sell some machines that week for 2 weeks and then come back down and do some more cleaning for easy rental. I picked them up my second day working in Murphy when they found out that I had moved up to Murphy from Pensacola. They wanted me to do all their stores in Atlanta. So the moment I transferred to Murphy, I picked up Easy Rental. So it was very, very strategically to my advantage because I got cooperation out of some of my buddies at Easy Rental and helping me stop the majority of those attacks. So I had cooperation out of Rent-A-Center as well. And the March 11th, 1997 tax that they tried to blow the city of Doraville off the map. But I got up that Monday morning and I was told that Joey Davis wanted to come and work for under me. My manager wanted to put me up assistant manager and wanted me to work Joey Davis. Well, Joey, I was shocked because Joey didn't like me. Now, I got along with his dad, and I'm still friends with his dad. But Joey Davis and I have never seen eye to eye on anything as far as any type of positive relationship whatsoever. One, you can't, he's not one of those type of people I can turn my back on. I've had plenty of people tell me, well, if you're around Joey, don't ever, you know, turn your back to him. The way it is with Joey. Now, Willard's always been my friend from the moment Willard and I met. We've always been friends, and we've maintained that, you know, friendship. Willard was not involved in any of the mess like the FBI had thought he was, and he just wasn't. Willard's a lot like me. He's one of those guys, well, he's retired now, but when he worked, when he got home, he didn't care what was happening over at the Joneses. He didn't care whose car was parked next door at what was supposed to be, because it just was none of his business. My kind of people. That's why Willard and I can get along so well, because we don't care about what all these other people are doing, celebrities or whatever. We don't care. We got our problems we got to deal with, and we can't deal with all these other people's problems, so we got our problems to deal with. So Willard minds Willard's business. He doesn't mind everybody else's. But that boy of his, I mean, he's just, you know, only way to put it is just he has always been a thorn in his daddy's side. But it was actually Willard's well shed that the cooks and Joey took that hydrogen bomb and set it in the evening of January 28, 1998, while Willard was at work. He was managing the Waffle King in Murphy. Dennis had got promoted to general manager of the Waffle Kings, so he promoted Willard to become manager. And there's a lot of story to Joey, and some of it's funny. It'll have you laughing, especially the part where he went up and decided to rob his place of employment back in 2011, the Huddle House up there in Andrews, North Carolina. Now, he decided to pull over there.
I think it was June 11th or something like that. He decided to pull over there at 3:23 a.m., put on a mask, parked his car over by the gas pumps of the gas station, part of the building, and put on a mask, came walking in the huddle house, pulled out a gun, pointed at the waitress, and told her to give him all the money in the cash register. And she's like, Joey, put down that gun. And, of course, the really lowered his voice. Why, Joey, don't call me Joey. Cook's over there, Joey, think about what you're doing. Shut up, I ain't Joey. You know, and some of the customers in there, Joey, son, think about what you're doing, man. You know, put the gun in. All right, Joey, next person calls me Joey, I'm going to shoot. You know? So, I mean, what could the waitress do? Reach in the cash register, pull out the $137, and give it to him. So he made out with a wallet, and I think it was $137. I mean, really worth the time of serving 8 years in prison, which he's going back, of course. He murdered Officer Robert Sanderson over there at the, you know, New Women's Healthcare Clinic. That was him, you know, he was the anonymous caller to the Centennial Park attack. And, now, he did get him a new occupation while he did serve his time and got put in a halfway house. He does cabinet work now.
He does what kind of work now?
Cabinet. Builds cabinets.
Okay.
So I guess he's probably gotten over there with the cooks. You know, Murphy builds a supply and cooks carpet flooring and all that. And, you know, of course, they're his neighbors, his daddy's neighbors, you know, and that was actually Frank, John, and Robert Cook's niece, okay, Mary. If it wasn't for her, we couldn't have got that hydrogen bomb surrendered. There was nobody in this entire world could have convinced that family to surrender that hydrogen bomb.
Well,
it took one of their own family members to do it. Now, if you want to...
Could you explain to people if that hydrogen bomb would have been detonated, you know, what would have happened?
It would have wiped everything out in a 10-mile radius. It would have deflected over the hill over there, Cook Ridge, so it wouldn't have completely destroyed the town of Murphy. But in a 10-mile radius... you're going to go off on the week. You had all the people over in Young Harris, Georgia, because Cook Ridge is a rock's throw from Young Harris, Georgia. You see, the Cook brothers, Frank, Robert, and John, grew up with Zell Miller. Zell and his family only lived across the creek there, across the state line from the Cooks. I mean, shoot, you can straddle the Georgia state line on that creek that runs between the community of Brasstown and Young Harris, Georgia. So the Miller boys spent plenty of nights eating dinner at the Cooks. The Cook brothers spent plenty of nights staying night over there at the Millers. I mean, they were pretty much like family. You know, Zell, he wound up marrying Shirley Carver, who is, you know, president of the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta.
Oh, wow.
Everybody talks about Hillary Clinton. Well, I mean, Hillary Clinton's only Shirley Carver's reflection is all Hillary is. Shirley, she's the one who determines who gets elected. In both political parties. She's the primary sponsor of the Democratic Party. She was Bill Clinton's and Hillary Clinton's mentor. She was Joe Biden's mentor. She was Barack Obama's mentor. I mean, if you needed any advice on how to do something, you went to Shirley Carver and Zell Miller.
If you wanted to
makes me wonder if they had any ties in with the Fanny thing in Georgia.
The what?
The Fanny fiasco that happened.
Oh, Fanny Willis.
Yes.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, I call it Washington mania, really. It's really, to me, you know, all for show, really. I never saw any type of conviction coming on Donald Trump for anything. If anything, I have the evidence that proves that Donald Trump is legally still the president of the United States because Joe Biden was disqualified as a presidential candidate.
Is that
and the
why,
reason,
you know, when you see the news reports and everything and the military had their backs turned when the cavalcade was going through, you know, for Biden going through, the military had turned their back?
Well, I hadn't seen that, but it wasn't surprising me one bit. I mean, when that newspaper article popped up out there in Australia about Hunter Biden being tied into child sex trafficking, that right then and there disqualified his daddy right then and there. That's not counting the fact, which, of course, I did meet Hunter in June of 1997.
Yeah, please tell us about that. Yeah.
Okay. They tried to hit the Ball Ground Elementary School baseball game back on June 3rd, 1997.
By hitting it, you mean they tried
die.
To bomb it? They had hidden stuff to restore a lot of lives there, right?
Yes, they had these explosives planted at all of these elementary school baseball fields, a lot of them by the dugouts. To where all they had to do was just walk up and reach down and pull up a couple of wires, attach a detonator, whether a timer or a remote, walk away, and detonate the explosive and kill children. They had every elementary school from Ball Ground Elementary over to the elementary schools in Cumming, Georgia, Gainesville, Georgia, all the way up to Asheville, North Carolina, out to Chattanooga, Tennessee, where they had gone out.
That goes to show that they probably had some, excuse me, sorry about that, but that goes to show there's probably some even planted in Alabama areas.
I don't think they were able to get quite that far, but
okay.
they were going to once they got there. They were going to do more. Anybody that did not support their fight against the government. You got to remember, all right, these people were involved in government, and they're
uh-huh.
going to overthrow the government. What does that tell you?
Guess what? They're going to get, what's that called, treason?
Well, yeah, sedition, conspiracy to overthrow the United States government. Okay, and the only reason that Hunter Biden and Jim Biden is getting out of that is they made an agreement that I got that bomb surrendered. When all this went down, they are to provide every name of every pedophile in the world. If they hold back one name, deals off. All they have to do is hold back one name. I want every name of every leader in this world that is involved in their child trafficking operations. I've got the ones in Atlanta, so they know they can't pull any wool over my eyes on that. But they have to provide every name in order to wash their hands of any criminal wrongdoing. They have to provide me every name of every child trafficker and pedophile they know. Or like everybody else that are guilty, they can face the firing squad.
I did not like having to give such a run, but I had to do some of the most outlandish, impossible things, and I did them. I did accomplish them. I have successfully fought child trafficking in the Republic of Peru as a U.S. envoy for the Bush administration in 2005 for the Toledo administration. That resulted in Operation Predator that rescued over 106 children as young as 5 years of age.
Thank you so much for that.
And it changed the economy in Peru. Peru is actually transitioning. There's some, it's pretty shaky down there right now, which is shaky here in the United States, because those were the two countries that they intended to take down in the 1990s was the United States and the Republic of Peru. And the Chinese Communist Party was very much involved.
Right.
Yeah, Sendero Luminoso, Abimael Guzman, that was leading what we know as the Shining Path, terrorist organization, and the only way they could be defeated was an armed militia had to go in and defeat them. The government couldn't do it. And it's getting to the point nowadays is about to go and be the same thing for the militias in this country. They're either going to stand with me and also stand with Donald Trump, or they can just go ahead and sit on back and go ahead and enjoy all these taxes they're having to pay, all of this big government intrusion that they're having to suffer from. Because everybody will notice that whenever North Carolina was declared a provisional state by Governor Hunt, we did not deploy the National Guard. We did not institute the curfews. We didn't go around snatching up guns and snatching up people. It was really supposed to be a 21-year run. Now it's going into 26 years. And I am not ready to allow another one of them to die from natural causes, especially John Ramsey, of all people in this world, the one that I really want sitting out there exposed to the world as the most disgusting human being ever created in this world, and that is John Bennett Ramsey.
Did you tell what he calls himself?
Ma'am?
Could you tell us what he calls himself?
Oh, John?
Yes.
Well, I really don't know if he's really grandiose delusional or if he is actually Satan himself, because he really thinks he is Satan himself.
And he said that he's going to, what was that? He said that reason why he's going to kill Beth.
Yeah, he told Beth and Matt after he had us killed, because you got to realize that Beth went way out to try to get her daddy busted with this bunch.
Right.
Because her and Matt, they had every intention of taking JonBenet and raising her as their child.
To protect her, yes.
Mm-hmm. They had been trying to find me for 9 months in 1991 because I had worked at that one Waffle House there in Marietta, there at the 120 Loop in Roswell Road, and there at the corner of Greenbrier Parkway in Roswell Road. It's Waffle House Unit 479. Now, Ed Bentley Jr. owns that building, all those buildings there on Greenbrier Parkway. He leases them out to other businesses, and also he has this place there where he builds the silencers for the U.S. military. I've had a lot of people looking at me in shock, Marietta, over that barn that is all the time caught on fire and it never burned down
over there just past the on-ramp from Roswell Road to the 120 loop. The one in
aren't
the Waffle House.
Aren't you asking some people that live in that area, too, to please get the people to do a search on that property, see if there's any, like, fingers or any kind of bone fragments where that barn was?
We're trying to push it, but we got Sheriff Craig Owens, the first black sheriff in Cobb County, sitting over there on his thumb. Now, I don't know if he's rotating his thumbs or not, but he is not willing to do anything along with the City of Marietta Police Department, because that's really city jurisdiction. Because there was one of those guys that shot those two black teenagers that I rescued from that barn over there that night. One of the snipers was a City of Marietta police officer.
Wow.
The other sniper was my cousin, Robert Veach. The other sniper was Ed Bentley Jr. All under the control of Cobb Assistant Magistrate Mike McLaughlin.
So a lot of people say, well, you know, I could go to the police and they don't handle it, then I just take it to court. But then you got a crooked magistrate, too. So it's like, what do you do when you're pretty much screwed? Would you have to go through that round through McLaughlin then, back when he was?
Oh, yeah. If you're
magistrate.
If you're on their blacklist, as many times as I've gone and tried to take warrants out for people that damaged my property, and to be set there and cussed out by that rat, because that's what he is, a rat. You know, I gave up picking out warrants on people in Cobb County a long time ago because it was a waste of time. Someone could walk up to me in a parking lot, get in a fight with them, defending myself, or even sit there and let them hit me and go take a warrant would do no good. Not with that judge. He has had it out for me.
Go ahead.
Well, it's because what I witnessed when I was in the eighth grade at Mabry Middle, him chasing this, he was a college student living out of state. The same Buick that he crashed into Grady Lynn Rawls's brick mailbox down in Evergreen, Alabama, was the same Buick I sat there on the back of the school bus on my way home from Mabry Middle, chasing this 1968 or 69 Chevrolet Chevelle SS that ran off the road and hit the brick mailbox of Sheriff Bill Hudson's sister. First time I met Mike McLaughlin in person was 3 days before my 18th birthday in November of 1983. He had just started his job at the courthouse working with the DA's office with a magistrate on pretrial release. You
wow.
won't believe who he brought over there to drop off there by Tip Top Poultry when we're all after we met over there at Layton Graphics. With John
he
Ramsey.
Did.
Yeah, you won't believe who he dropped off.
Who did he drop off?
Franklin Delano Floyd, known as Bill.
Oh, Ramsey. No.
Serial killer.
Right.
All these guys are serial killers. Every one of them. John Wayne Gacy, this is proven that John Wayne Gacy did not murder all of his victims. He was actually out of town when one of his victims was murdered. Guess who said he murdered that victim? Doug McRae.
Wow.
Now, we're talking Radio Shack. Now, if anybody wants to kind of get an idea of what Doug McRae looks like, I don't have a picture of him, but they can go to the Levi Frady sites and they can pull up even some of my groups on Facebook. We care, and we definitely care, in the Levi Frady Murder Not Unsolved.
Yes.
And you'll have these two composite sketches that was seen in the area at the time of Levi's abduction. Well, one gentleman was seen going door to door, knocking on doors at the time of his abduction. And this is where you get the fine print out from between the lines in the Levi Frady murder. The other composite sketch, well, the guy seen going door to door, well, that was Jim Vickers, the branch manager of Electrolux in Gainesville. I had two appointments.
Okay, I still remember who, because I remember when you were talking about when the last time when that came into being, the Electrolux and the Radio Shack. So, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I don't remember if we'd covered that in one of our interviews or not. But they tried to set me up for Levi's murder. Jim had just a tad bit lighter gray minivan than what I had. His was a Dodge Caravan, and mine was a Plymouth Voyager. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think we went over the part about the murder and stuff like that. No, we didn't cover that part.
Okay. Well, I had appointments set to work in Elegy that day. I wound up selling three machines. One was my 1 o'clock appointment, and the other one was at 5:30. So I get in my office that morning, and Charlie, that is my branch manager, told me he had an appointment. I needed to go deliver a bottom line canister vacuum cleaner to Cumming, Georgia. I said, Charlie, just call it in one of the other branches. I got appointments over here in LJ. And, of course, if I had appointments, they were sales, because I would generate my own appointments. I didn't need any blind dates. I really didn't like running office appointments at all, even though I have. To me, I had all the clientele in the world. All I had to do was go out and meet them. That was my philosophy.
And were you basically independent salesperson at that time?
Yes, ma'am. I was an independent contractor. I was not an employee, so he could not fire me for refusing to take his appointment. Now, if I had been an assistant manager, which would have been an employee, he could have fired me for refusing to run that appointment. He told me, well, you go in there and you call your 5:30, see if they'll reschedule. I said, okay. So I went in and I called the couple, and they didn't want to reschedule. And I tried to convince them to let another rep from another office come over. They did not want that. They were interested in what I had talked to them about, and they were only interested in me coming over there and showing them the equipment. And they were interested in looking at the equipment, which told me right then and there it was a sale. So
yeah,
I came out and I told Charlie, I said, well, Charlie, they're not rescheduling. Well, you run that 5:30 without going out there to Cumming. I don't care if you sell machines, and I'll fire you. I said, okay. I stepped outside, smoked a cigarette, and drink a cup of coffee, and Matt McRae came walking out of the Radio Shack, and he goes, yeah, Charles, we heard that you got his, what you think will be the sale over there in LJ. If you go to that 5:30 without going to Cumming, we're going to come over there and kill you and your customers. So I was pretty little shook up after that.
I was tripping. I knew they were going to try to set me up. And I, something just told me they were going to murder a child over there and try to set me up. So something just told me that.
Right. So I didn't know what I was going to do, but I wasn't having breakfast at no Waffle King. I couldn't do me any good to find any law enforcement in Cherokee County, North Carolina, to report it to. So I drove down to Ellijay to the Waffle House for my breakfast that morning. So I'm sitting in, the place is packed out. I'm looking around. I don't see a cop one. I don't see a plainclothes detective, nobody pertaining to law enforcement. I sat there for like 30 minutes after I ate, hoping I would see a deputy or someone come in that restaurant. Nobody. Just regular customers. So I'm like, oh, my gosh. I go walking outside, and I hear my name. Look to my right, and I hear it again. I look to my left, and there's this distinguished-looking gentleman standing by a white Chevrolet Silverado, motions me over to his pickup truck. So I go walking over there, and he goes, "You're Charles Rogers?" I said, "Yes." Special Agent Steve Maxwell of the GBI, Chatsworth's field office. It's my understanding the FBI's got your office staffed up there in Murphy, and you've been threatened with termination if you don't go to Cumming. I said, "Man, I can't be talking to you. They got these bugs on my vehicle." "Well, wait a minute. Just, okay." Reaches, pulls out a briefcase, pulls out what looked like an odometer, one of those test meters. We go walking over to my van. I pop the hood on it. He hooks it up to the battery. Which he told me before we got over there, if I had any pagers or recorders or anything that had batteries in them, it was going to drain the batteries, which I didn't have a pager. So anything else that had batteries would drain except for the car battery. So he drained the batteries on their trackers and their listening devices on my vehicle for me. It took about 10 minutes. About 7 minutes into it, that's when he started talking real low, and he was like, "What do you think they got planned over there in Cumming?" And I said, "Well, it's not going to be a terrorist attack because they're sending me to a neighborhood. So I imagine they're going to abduct and murder a child and try to pin it on me." He goes, "Well, you got any places you can go?" I said, "Yeah, I got a 1 o'clock and 5:30 here in Gilmer County." "You know, what do you think they'll buy?" I said, "Yeah, I'm going to sell a shampoo or polisher over here at my 1 o'clock, and I'm going to sell a twin upright package over here at my 5:30. "All right. Well, you got someone you can call that other lead into?" I said, "Yeah, I'll call this one into the Gainesville Electrolux branch and see if one of the reps out there run it." "That's a good idea. Do that. Find somewhere to hang out between your appointments." So I said, "Yeah, I'll just go over here to Waffle King and hang out between my two appointments." And that's what I did. I went over there and hung out the Waffle King after I left my 1 o'clock at 3 o'clock. So I was sitting in the Waffle King in Ellijay at the time of Levi's abduction. So I went to my 5:30. They had unmarked cars riding by this couple's house, and they were like, "Well, I wonder what the presence of law enforcement is out here today." I said, "Well, it's on the account of me." "On the account of you?" I was like, "Yeah, so I tried to call you this morning and reschedule an appointment because the people that are responsible for the Oklahoma City bombing and the Olympic Park attack are trying to make me go to Cumming and said they'd come over here and kill me and y'all too if I showed up over here today." "Oh, really? Well, we do not support what happened out there in Oklahoma City, and we sure don't support what happened down there at that park. We want to take a look at what you got
this is our family over here all around us. They want to come over here and shoot it out. We'll be more than happy to shoot it out with them. So we want to look at what you got. So I went in, showed them, and wrote it up. I was 8:30 leaving, which I, most of the time when I was showing equipment, it was really showing the customers how to use the equipment. Getting them used to it. That way they knew how to use it, you know, change the, you know, the brushes around on the shampooer, how to use the attachments for the uprights and canisters. It was really showing them how to use their equipment. That's always was my technique. And just ask them their opinions of everything. Answer a question professionally with a question where the customer had to answer the question. That was my gig. And I would stop by the Chevron there in Blue Ridge, got me a cup of coffee and a pack of cigarettes on my way home. I was at home at 9:30. My dad wound up doing his own little personal investigation on me that weekend. Levi was abducted from his mother's house. He was on his bicycle. He was about to leave and ride down to the street to his friend's house, who was, you know, Mexican. When his dad,
you remember Levi's?
Frady,
you remember Levi's last name?
Levi Frady.
Frady, that's a boy's name.
Yes, ma'am. Levi Frady.
Yeah, how do you spell that last name?
F as in Frank, R as in Raymond, A as in Apple, D as in Dog, Y in Yellow.
Okay, because I remember the that name.
Levi's call in Georgia before it was Amber Alert. It was a Levi's call.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then they changed it to the Amber Alert. But first it was the Levi call. Now it's the Amber Alert. Levi Frady was abducted by his daddy, Milton Frady, Craig Manier of Home Depot, and Danny Hughes of King's Leathercraft in Murphy, North Carolina. Doug McRae of the Radio Shack is the other feller, the composite sketch with a gruffy-looking face with a ball cap.
Right.
You can go to the Oakland County child killer case, and you can look at the young guy with the brown hair, kind of a short-looking guy. That is the younger version of Doug McRae. You can put the two composite sketches next to each other and tell they're the same guy.
Oh, wow. And that's sad to see the own father would do that, but we're seeing a lot of cases where the own parents are doing that today. A lot of people might not try to believe. They try to say, oh, it's getting worse and stuff like that. It's been bad all along. It's just now because we got the internet, more of this stuff is coming out.
That's what it is. It's like the Summer Wells case over there. There's nobody convinced that the parents were not involved. Everybody believes the parents were, in fact, involved.
Believe it or not, there's still a lot of people, like if you go to White Boy over there at YouTube, he swears up and down that they're innocent, you know, and all that. He's got YouTube videos, and he goes, well, they, you know, they got all their cell phones, and there ain't no, they did not get all their cell phones because they had some burner phones, and they never turned in.
Well, see, that's why I know so much about the Levi Frady, the Beth and JonBenet Ramsey murders, is because even though I wasn't present at their murders, I know people who were present. Okay.
Right.
I'm not going to name any names right now.
Exactly.
You know, anybody can go over there to the Fulton County State Court
and they can pull the case of Roger Dow Nance versus Charles R. Rogers, and there's about 5 pounds of evidence over there they can go through. It's got a lot of the names. It doesn't have a lot of the names of my confidential witnesses because I'm using Rule 34-2 of the federal court in North Carolina to withhold the identity of my other witnesses because I have to.
Well, you got to have them safe so that they don't end up, you know, like gone, you know, like a lot of the other ones, you know.
Yeah, or raided and given a injection like I was given in 2013.
Was the whole family threatened that if you continue on and everything else?
Oh, these people have been known to murder entire families.
Exactly.
They don't even have the regard
for
their own children. Why would they have the regard for the lives of anyone else's?
And sometimes I wonder if for a fact when they say that, I'm not saying all cases, but I'm sure there's some cases where they try to blame the parent of killing everybody in the household and then he kill himself. I'm sure there's cases where, you know, it's really them that done it and they just framed him to make it look like he did it.
Well, that's like I have a lot of people, they say all this negative stuff about Hunter Biden, and hey, believe me, you know, from their perspective, got every right. But one thing I did get out of Hunter, and this was before I met with his uncle, he didn't even agree with what he was brought up in. When I had my talk to him, the questions that I asked him, he looked at me real funny, and he was like, I never thought of it that way, but you are right. I don't agree with this now that you mention it. I told him, I said, just continue what you're doing. But when all this comes down, we're going to have to give them a 20-something year run to get that hydrogen bomb surrendered. But at the end of this, I don't care how guilty you are. I want the name of everyone involved. I said, if you can do that, I can probably convince the American people to keep you out of prison, but it's going to take 100% of your cooperation. I said, I don't give a damn how you get your daddy in as president if you have to do it by fraud. But you get him in there. And they did. So I'm like everybody else. I can't wait to see what the final conclave is all this is going to be about because these people had every intention of ripping this country apart by the seams in the 1990s. They have the money. They have right now they're losing their power right now as we speak.
Right.
And they're finding out.
So they're going crazy.
Two of the guys that they put stalking me at Piedmont Hospital in July of 2001 while my daddy was dying in the ICU, and they failed to get rid of me on the 7th of July. They were going to kill me while my daddy was dying in the hospital. I didn't think my brother would stoop to that level when he offered me to go down Peachtree Street to this little cafeteria for a cup of coffee. I had a funny feeling it was a little bit more than what he was suggesting, but I went ahead and got in the car and rode over there with him anyway. He went over to the Shell gas station. It's not there anymore. They tore it down and built some buildings there. Pulled in there, and he picked up Roger Nance. So last person, I had already tried to get a protective order on those two. The 25th of June. And Mike McLaughlin sat there and threatened Danny Kiss
and Jean Bertrand and me threatened to have all three of us locked up and killed in jail if we didn't get out of that courthouse.
Wow.
Wow.
So now Danny's suing on in the U.S. District Court in Atlanta. He's suing Mike McLaughlin. He's suing Eric Rudolph because Fred and Roger decided to lure him and me from over in Dawsonville, Georgia, over into Forsyth County, going to have us executed 2 days after my birthday in 1997. People want to know why I don't celebrate birthdays. I got a damn good reason. I've almost been killed on a lot of my birthdays. I just give up. So I don't even celebrate them anymore. If I had not told them just to go ahead and execute me and spare my friend, we were dead. They had mistaken him as an undercover agent or undercover officer. And he was a commercial truck driver. He was actually driving for Mansfield Oil and was on lockdown for over 2 hours on March the 11th, 1997, when they tried to hit all those places over there in Doraville, including the IRS building, the General Motors assembly plant, Peachtree DeKalb Airport, Citgo fueling facility for the truckers, the AmeriGas propane distribution facility, and, of course, Mansfield Oil was the ones that stored the jet fuel for Delta Airlines. So that's who Danny was hauling for. Two of those guys that they put in the hospital to watch me, they was working at this one gas station there at the, I think it's the intersections, Chambly Dunwoody Road and Buford Highway. That's got this retail space in the same building as the convenience store. Well, they were there remodeling when someone put a backpack explosives out there by the dumpster. Plus to the gas pumps, they were going to detonate, and these guys were there working. Of course, police came out and disarmed it. The first target was the IRS building. Well, when they pulled up to the IRS building, there was two trucks blocking the entrance, so they couldn't pull into the entrance, so they had to turn around. They came down to the Rent-A-Center where I was working at. Went in there and held three employees, me hostage for almost 3 hours. There was three truck bombs in those attacks that morning. One was for the, like I said, the GM assembly plant there in Doraville, the MARTA rail station. They were going to blow the pull it up under the tracks there and blow the tracks off, and shut down the MARTA rail section there. And, of course, kill a bunch of people. But all of those fuel places and that assembly plant, it was just nothing but a powder keg. It would have blown just the entire city of Doraville off the map. I mean, when you look at what happened in Oklahoma City, people think that all those buildings that was damaged was from the debris and the stuff from the explosive itself. Now, a lot of those buildings were destroyed because of the breaks of the gas mains.
Oh, man.
You'll see after a bombing, you'll see the gas sitting there burning out of the ground, and people be wondering, well, why don't they just shut off the gas? Oh, yeah, good idea. You get the oxygen up into those gas mains. Where that gas is, they're more combustible. So you can blow up city blocks turning off that gas.
Oh,
buildings
wow.
get damaged inside from the gas when they turn off the gas. Some of them buildings will blow up inside. That is why
right.
you had That's why you had the damage to six city blocks in Oklahoma City. Was it just from the explosives planted inside and that truck bomb that was detonated on the outside? But the damages from the gas mains is what destroyed the other buildings.
Well,
so that's why you no longer have those six city blocks and you have a lake and you have a memorial out there now.
Yeah, I'm not sure when we touched base on the Black Widow Chapter 2 or not, or whether, I don't know, but we got 8 minutes left.
Well, let's go ahead and get old Lynn out of the way. I mean, old Julian Lynn Womack, you won't believe who helped me stop the second truck bomb attempt on that General Motors assembly plant.
Who?
Was actually her uncle, Alan Helms.
Wow.
He was a neighbor of my mother over there by Sprayberry and East Cobb. We had another neighbor. I can't tell his name right now. He worked at the Lakewood General Motors Assembly Plant. He's the one that helped me stop the attack on, you know, truck bomb attack on that assembly plant. The breach in security was two sections of chain link fence that were missing from that side access road. So it appears that General Motors, like Home Depot, was involved in the attempted truck bombings of both of their facilities.
Wow.
Fox Theaters Incorporated were responsible for the attempted truck bombing of Valentine's Day, 1997, is when they tried to do it on the Fox Theater. Yeah, we can thank L.M. Wood for getting two of those officers that assisted in stopping that attack fired from the Atlanta Police Department. And so if people want to know what I think about L.M. Wood, every time I wipe my butt, I think of him. she's
a lot of people don't know the negative about him, but you do because you knew him personally or know him.
Well, I didn't know him personally. He only got paid $100,000 out of representing Rick Jewell. He was mad as hell at me because I got Rick reinstated as a deputy sheriff because Rick didn't want that $3.5 million. Now, Rick went to work with Nancy Schaefer and me in exposing the Child Protective Services scandals. And that's why I think that they killed Rick with a heart attack gun. And they just inadvertently executed Nancy and her husband, Roger. And after Rick died, Nancy, she had a tendency to want to back off. Rick died 10 days before our next meeting, while we had scheduled. Unexpectedly. There's no reason why Rick should have.
I don't think so.
Yeah, he had diabetes. But, you know, he didn't have bad heart trouble. And just all of a sudden died of a heart attack. The same thing with my buddy of the Easy Rental, Sam Evans. The same thing. He didn't have heart trouble, but died of a heart attack. He was working at the Forest Park location when he died. When he helped me stop the attacks, he was working at the Evans Street location there at the West End. And, but anyway, Lynn, she used to work with my cousin Bonnie Rogers at 911 dispatch for Cobb County. And she just had that reputation over there in Sprayberry area. Just, you know, anybody's girl, anybody could have had her. And she worked with the DA's office for a little while. But Glenn was a murder suspect when Glenn was killed. Randy Thompson was involved in a traffic stop, if I remember correctly, according to Craig Manier, that day they decided they were going to get rid of me. My daddy died in the hospital over there. And Marilyn Parkman, when I talked to her, that Randy Thompson had done a traffic stop over there in Forsyth County as a deputy that resulted in $3,500 worth of methamphetamine being seized that belonged to Milton Frady and Marilyn Parkman that was on consignment to them from Marshall Talbot and Eric Rudolph. So that ran their drug debt up to almost $80,000. So there's more to the story about Julian Lynn Womack Turner. That is Patty Hallen's adopted niece. After she lost her parents, she was a distant relative of the Womacks, is the reason why Patty's sister adopted her. I believe she was involved in both her husband and her boyfriend's homicides, but I do not think she acted alone. They had murdered this girl in 1991. I'm a witness to that homicide. Witnessed that before I met Beth Ramsey a couple of weeks later.
You were 17 years old around that time, am I right?
In 91, no, ma'am. I was like 26, I think. 91?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, about 26. She was around 21, 22. I mean, just a baby doll. I mean, this lady, I have, you know, I'll tell people, if there was any lady in the world that wrote a book on how to be a lady, it was Beth Ramsey. That boyfriend of hers, Matt Darrington.
We got 90 seconds.
90 seconds, okay.
Yes.
Well, we don't think that Lynn Turner killed herself in prison. There's reason to believe that she possibly helped murder her grandmother. I don't know the validity of that, but I'm not going to lose sleep over it. But Lynn Turner did not act alone when she got rid of her husband, Sergeant Glenn Turner.
Right.
Bridget Clodfelter is another one of their victims.
Sergeant Lynn Turner, what was another one of the victims you said?
Bridget Clodfelter.
Okay.
She hung out at the Buckboard Saloon, where all the cops like to hang out, her and Cheryl Underwood. So those two homicides are related. They were murdered by members of the Cobb County Police Department Precinct 4, known as the Rat Pack.
So would you like to say anything in closing, and we'll get on with the next time, we'll continue from there?
Well, everybody's got a Bible. Just flip over there to Matthew chapter 18 and read what Tim Ballard has stolen from me. You know, I want everybody out there using that particular passage.
The strings over now.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, if Jesus gave his life fighting pedophilia, people don't realize what he was speaking about when he came here, but he was fighting a war against those Pharisees, the pedophiles of his time, that he had. He took the cross, standing up against the same people, or the bloodlines of the same people we are up against today. I know it sounds far-fetched. I know it's hard to accept. Nobody wants to have to accept it, but it's just what it is.
Right, exactly. Well, I thank you for coming, and we'll continue on with this with chapter 3 the next time, so that we can continue on with the.
Well, I hope that's to help waking everybody up. It's It's something we have to face sooner or later. We might as well go ahead and face it now and get it over with.
You're right. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming. You always bring a lot of insight and you bring hope. And thank you for fighting the good fight for us.
Well, thank you for your prayers and support. And hopefully I look forward to seeing you and many others up there in Raleigh when I get up there and kick that doggone Democrat out of my office.
That's right. All right. Well, I'll talk to you later. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
God bless. God bless.